Let's hear some. Give me the Kermicam version of your favorite British airplane. These guys want to know. They want to know the
favorite
nuts and bolts
British
of
airplane.
Taking off in a pup or something fun. Give us the real down and dirty details of this thing or the Sunderland. I don't care what it is, but these folks want to hear some flying stories. So can you give us one?
Well, the Sunderland was an awesome trip because we picked it up over there and we flew it, you know, to Ireland, and then the winds were against us to make it all the way across to, even though it's got a 16-hour endurance, to make it to, we ended up in Goose Bay. But so about 2 weeks before we left, I went up to Iceland and checked it out in Reykjavik. It used to be a Sunderland base. And they had one buoy sitting out there, so we got a chance to go up there, hang around Iceland, do a little bit of work. And the weather over the North Atlantic was a little bit bad, so we got a chance to check around the Blue Lagoon and soak in the hot springs and kind of looked at some really nice blondes at the bar. And then we left over, and we actually left Reykjavik with a 40-knot tailwind.
Wow.
And we ended up, it was a 10-hour flight to Goose Bay, and we ended up here in 1994 with the Sunderland, and we got here a minute before our scheduled airshow time on the first day of the flying. It was really cool. We flew pretty much every day, operated out of Lake Winnebago and did tours. We had a pontoon boat. The Sunderland's great, and one day we'll get it flying again when I get my little seaplane base going. And the last time I flew it, I was the longest relay on the Olympic torch relay to the Atlanta Games in 96, I think it was. And I flew the airplane down to Sarasota. They brought it out in a boat, you know, with a wall of people behind them. And I'm like, how am I going to start this thing and not hit anybody? Okay, and because once you start one, you're moving and you're turning. Okay, and you know, there's no brakes on the Sunderland. The Martin Mars was cheating because they had reversible props on 2 and 3. But anyway, so we flew it every day, and that's a grand old lady.
It's a beautiful grand old lady, yeah. Too. Great lines, too. Stephen Bridgewater, who is a friend, when we moved over to the Middle East to our quote-unquote undisclosed location that I'm happy to discuss in public with you off this mic and stage and going around the world, by the way, on EAA radio tonight. Stephen's the only friend that when we said we were moving over there, he said, well, I'll be there. When should I come? And he came. He and his wife came over. And one of my favorite Stephen campfire stories is about the time he bought a Nimrod. As you do when you're working in a museum. And would you give us the quick story about you buying the Nimrod?
It's
a barn burner.
Okay. I was, as Matt said, the commercial director for an aeroplane museum we had in the UK, Air Atlantique. I'm sure Kermit knows Air Atlantique, with our fleet of DC-3s and DC-6s and then a variety of vintage aeroplanes that we kept flying, including the Meteor, which is outside. And we got a phone call one day from a friend of mine who worked at Rolls-Royce saying, the RAF are getting rid of the Nimrods. One of the sales has fallen through. I don't suppose you know anybody who would like to buy a Nimrod. A Nimrod, I should point out, is a big four-engine jet maritime patrol aeroplane, anti-submarine, big nuclear depth charge bay underneath. It's a big aeroplane, not a PPL-type aeroplane. So I spoke to our financier, the chap who created the collection, and he said, I think we should maybe look into it. So I was charged with trying to
Offer on the Nimrod, as you would do.
So I phoned the base. The base said, we'd love you to have it. We know you're not going to fly the aeroplane. At least you'll keep it running. You'll keep it ticking over. You'll keep it serviceable as a tribute to the people who flew and maintained them. But we need you to go through something called the Defense Disposals Agency, which is the part of the Air Force charged with getting as much money back for selling this property as possible. So I phoned them, and they said, we need to make as much money selling you the aeroplane as if we sold it for scrap. So I said, okay, what's the scrap value on a Nimrod? And they said, it's £15,000. £15,000. So Mike, the collection financier, said, well, what do you want to do, Steve? And I said, I think we should make them an offer. So I faxed my offer through. It was back in the days of fax machines. And we heard nothing more for 2 or 3 months.
But now the story gets interesting.
I then got a phone call from Squadron Leader Roxy Roxburgh, a good RAF name, saying, hi, Steve, we're bringing you your Nimrod on Tuesday. What time would you like it? So I said, well, we haven't actually done a deal yet, Roxy. So he said, well, you better come up for lunch. So we flew up and had lunch, and we worked on the basis that The aeroplane would fly down to us on Tuesday. The RAF were going to take some pieces off it that they needed to recycle onto the replacement aeroplanes.
Now, Group Captain Stevens, don't report back on this. This is the sensitive part now. So
this is detachment rules.
Yeah.
At which point, once these bits have been taken off the aeroplane, it will no longer be flyable. So what are they going to do if you've not done a deal? They can't take it back out of the airfield. So sure enough, the aeroplane turned up on the Tuesday. Friday afternoon, I was handed the keys to the aeroplane, and it was ours. We'd not had an invoice. We'd not had anything. 3 months later, an invoice turned up for £15,000. So I picked up the phone, called Defence Disposal, and said, "But I only offered you five." And they said, "Well, we'd better accept £5,000 then." So effectively, we bought a Bowser for £5,000 that we managed to siphon the fuel off and kept most of our fleet flying for the rest of the
that's
year.
That's the other. That's the other part of the story, though.
That was
the Nimrod. How much fuel was on board? Because this is the barn burner part.
There was about 17 tons of fuel on board when it came in. So it was probably my best. But my wife said it was my best bargain.
That's right.
When I got married, my best man came out with a 72nd scale one, not Steve.
So, yeah, that's I love it. Bought the whole thing right there. Kermit, you should bring Steve along when you're negotiating on some of these projects.
I have a $12,000 Super Constellation.
There you go. All right, Group Captain Stevens, you have to regale us with a quick campfire story. And then, Chris, I'm coming to you next, so be thinking.
Sure, yeah.
Or Dave, well, here I am. Gosh.
15 years in the cockpit, there's a lot of stories that I can't tell here. But I could tell you that when you're a squadron boss, things change, and obviously you're in charge of people, you're looking after them, making sure they're good, and you never want to hear that phone call. Well, it happened to me. I was actually away in Europe at the time, and I got the phone call, and it was, "Boss, there's something you should know." "Okay, tell me." Fortunately, it wasn't a fatality or anything like that. But at the time, I was on a training squadron, and we used to fly the Domini, or the HS-125. And we had one single pilot who sat in the left-hand seat. So they trained people like me to be a pilot's assistant, and our job was to recover the aircraft should the pilot ever feel unwell or whatever, and basically take the aircraft and land it. It was like an insurance policy. Everybody said it's never going to happen. Well, on this occasion it had, and it's quite remarkably, the pilot, they were down at low level in the UK, and the pilot said, "You know what, I don't feel so good. Could you take the aeroplane for a moment?" Very polite, clearly. And so the pilot assistant took control of the aircraft, looked around, and the guy had fainted.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so this was training come good, because suddenly he was in charge of the aircraft, and the pilot was no longer conscious. So they dragged him out, took him to the back of the airplane, put him on oxygen, and the navigator, the pilot assistant, landed the aircraft. He just flew a visual circuit into a local airfield. In fact, it was Newcastle, if anybody knows where that is, and landed it. So there I am in a foreign country getting a phone call as the boss. "You should know about this." Unfortunately, it all came out good. But that's the kind of thing you don't want to hear when you're the squadron boss. I have to say the worst one I heard was when I found out that one which was against the rules. I'm afraid he didn't last long. He left the squadron quite quickly. But yeah,
he's now flying for Ryanair. Is that the right story? We all know about.
I couldn't possibly comment, but
yeah. Yeah, there we go.
I think he got a job with Delta, actually.
No, that makes more sense. There you go.
Hope there's no one from Delta out there. I'm going home with you guys tomorrow. No, Wednesday.
I love it. That's funny. Now, Dave, a man of your stature in the warbird world, certainly you have a great campfire story that we can relate to the centennial of the RAF and all of the great stuff we're talking about tonight. But regale us with one.
Well, I don't know about a single story, but I did spend 2 summers barnstorming in the Lysander. And that was quite an experience. We had this perfectly serviceable, right out of restoration, Westland Lysander in the collection. And there was a fellow in Toronto who had a big investment fund called the Lysander Fund. And he said, "Can I put my name in your airplane and you just fly it around all summer and I'll pay the bill?" So I said, "Sure, I can do that." And it's really fun to show up at a pancake breakfast in a Lysander.
In a Lysander.
Yeah. Instead of a $100 hamburger, it's a $1,000 hamburger. But very interesting airplane, very, very strange. So we're talking about, everybody probably knows what a Lysander is, I hope, a great big 1937 observation airplane in the British.
Almost like a Stinson Gullwing, but much larger.
On steroids, yeah. Very yeah, definitely. Right. And brakes never worked. The elevator's not big enough to control the airplane at either end of the envelope. And
minor details here, Dave. I mean, come on.
it was a lot of fun to work good performance out of it, make the airplane perform and behave when you were dealing with... For example, if you come into land and you have the trim in the middle and you pull the power off, the nose will just drop. Mm. And you can have the stick right back into your spine and, well, you'll end up in a somersault. So when you come into, a couple of hundred feet, you hold the stick and then start winding the trim back in a commit point situation and then pull the power off and then you have enough authority. So you're pre-trimming the airplane for the next phase of flight. And the whole summer went like that. It was most interesting. But that summer took place, and the next summer took place. And my total maintenance bill, and this was 6 months of flying, maybe about 75 hours or so, was $150. There was once at a little grassroots airport, I had to hire the local mechanic to fix a little fuel leak on the side of a carburetor. It was a robust airplane. And... I had a tremendous amount of fun in it.
In the Lysander, barnstorming. Kermit, what's the craziest airplane you've ever taken to a pancake breakfast? Have you ever just shown up in something completely bizarre? Like
Ford Trimotor.
Ford Trimotor, yeah. Haul a bunch of pancakes home in that thing, yeah, can't you?
Brought a lot of my friends.
I love it. Well, look, I've warmed them up. Now it's up to you. Does anybody have a question tonight? We have some microphones out here tonight. We have some folks down there that would love to talk to you. And we have a campfiree right over here. Go right ahead as soon as the mic gets to you, or just come on down, as they would say. Come on down here and see Steve. He has a microphone, and this gentleman is way over here in the far off corner.
We have one in the center.
And if you're going to ask Lord Bridgewater where his mustache and best queen costume are, they're backstage. But we're going to spare you that, Stephen.
We decided against that.
We decided against it.